Getting excited for baseball season. Spring training now in full vigor, and the season upon us shortly. Our hometown Royals have made some news this offseason, not just with the signing of Mike Moustakas, but with a program that they have initiated, helping the players to avoid pornography. Have you caught any wind of this? An organization that is aimed at helping not just professional athletes, but both men and women to understand the dangers of pornography, has partnered with the Royals, and the Royals have held one seminar, and it's likely that others will be held as well. All of the minor league players were required to attend this at spring training. Many of the major leaguers who we root for attended. Ned Yost was there. Dayton Moore organized it and supported the event. The organization is called Fight the New Drug. They have done research, biomedical research, analysis of brain patterns, and looking at how pornography and its effects on the human brain can be addictive, just like a drug. Dayton Moore commented, "We do a lot for our players because we want them to compete every single day at the highest level against the best of the best. And we want to protect them from different ills of society so they can go out there and do what they love and celebrate what they do on the field. So I do think we should constantly look at ways to help improve the character and help mold and shape our players. I do. We talk about pornography and the effects of what that does on the minds of players and the distractions and how that leads to the abuse, domestic abuse, and abuse of women." I'll end my quote there. And it's true. Pornography can lead to laziness, lack of concentration. And if you are a baseball executive or coach, you understand that baseball, by its very nature, requires great concentration. The pace of the game is a bit slower, so you always have to be concentrating. It's a great mental skill for baseball players. While some were happy about this decision, not everyone, in fact, some of the pundits in the sports media, took right to the Royals and their decision to help grown men with addiction to pornography. One CBS sports writer wrote, quote, "I have to say, this sounds like something a high school coach would do to his team. All Major League Baseball teams should work with their players to prevent sexual abuse and domestic violence. But porn? It's one thing to be in a motivational speaker. It's another for the team's leadership to push their personal beliefs on the grown men they employ." End quote. The Royals have taken it on the chin a bit for trying to look out for their players and get to the core issue that leads to abuse of women and domestic violence and really an objectification of women and pornography, besides the fact it doesn't help them be better baseball players. Right? The Royals have taken a stand to try to do something good. The leadership has seen in their stewardship of the team an opportunity, and some could argue a responsibility, to take care of their players, to train their minds, to train their hearts for on-the-field play and off-the-field living. And because of the stewardship they've exhibited, the commitment to something beyond just baseball, they have been chastised. This morning I want to think with you about discipleship and why sometimes our discipleship might not get lots of likes, to use a social media metaphor. Turn with me to Luke chapter 12. If you're a guest with us, we've been walking through Luke's gospel in 2017 and here in 2018. We're now in chapter 12. We walk through books one at a time. And last week, Travis preached here in the heart of Luke 12 and about God's provision, not needing to be anxious and to fear God and trust his provision. We are in the midst of a long discourse by Jesus here in Luke chapter 12. I was speaking with someone just this week about preaching the Gospels and the difficulties sometimes of knowing how much to take on and how much we can handle in one setting. Ideally, all of Luke 12 could be one message. Here we have a long discourse by Jesus, and along the way there are a couple of interruptions, but we're getting to the point, having covered it in some smaller units along the way, that we now have enough of a view of the sequence of what Jesus said to step back and see how this is beginning to come together, almost as if we are in a museum and there's a painting that's in sequence. Here's one section and then a break and another section and a break and another section and a break and so forth. And here, those breaks in Luke 12 are provided by the actual statements of what's going on as Jesus teaches. We begin with Jesus teaching the disciples, and then someone from the crowd interrupts what Jesus is saying and asks for a favor. Jesus makes a statement, then turns again to his disciples. That is followed by Peter wondering exactly who Jesus is talking to, because this is not weeks separated. This is just minutes. This is one discourse. It's not separated by several sermons. So here, as we'll see today, Peter's question has validity to it. Now, who is this for? Because you were talking, it seems, to just us, but there's a crowd around. You've been interrupted. Now it seems you've kind of turned your attention back to us. And how are we to make this all out? Toward the end of the chapter, it's explicit that Jesus is again speaking to all of the crowds. So in the midst of the statement of who the direct audience is, Jesus is making these statements about the kingdom of God, about the mission that he is on, and in response somewhat yet to chapter 11. So here, if we can handle Luke 12 and see the segments, we could even take maybe one more step back and look at this series of paintings, one after another broken, and then maybe we could look and see how this whole wall and the wall beside us here and behind us is one sequence after another, but it's all fitting together. In Luke 11, Jesus is challenging the Pharisees, the scribes, about hypocrisy, because his teaching is by its very nature revelatory. It reveals what's inside. Someone's eyes and what they value, what they look to, is determined by their heart's affection. Just as today, you may have an eye for a certain item in a store because you like those items. There are lots of items in stores that you and I wouldn't even know are there because we don't have an interest in them. Someone who's interested in the kingdom shows it, in Jesus' language in Luke 11, by their good eyes. They see because they're ready to receive on the inside. This hypocrisy sequence then leads to chapter 12. And it's here, look at chapter 12 and verse 1. In these circumstances, a crowd of many thousands came together so that they were trampling on one another. Luke's language needs to be understood as the basis for what is being said here. These are the circumstances surrounding his teaching. This large crowd is gathered, and Jesus turns first to his disciples, it said. So there's a large crowd around, many thousands. Think of an arena of some kind, and lots of people around trampling on. This is how popular Jesus has become. And this, again, is a bit of a threat to the disciples, because the large size of the crowd is an angst to the Pharisees and scribes and their power. The large size of the crowd threatens them. The larger the crowd, the greater the threat politically for these leaders. So Jesus' disciples now have reason to be concerned for themselves. And this is why Jesus, in this sequence of ideas, begins, "Don't fear man. Fear God. Don't be afraid of them. Fear the one who has the power to not only kill, but throw you into hell afterward. Fear God and trust him. The hairs of your head have all been numbered. The birds of the sky, they're all numbered." And Jesus' language is such that all of them for all time have been numbered. All the hairs of all the heads for all time have already been set out. All the birds have already been counted and numbered. It's all known. There's nothing not known by God, and he promises to take care of you. So even in the danger of persecution, trust him. He's more concerned for your testimony than you are, so much so that in that hour, don't worry about what to say, because the Spirit will teach you. This is the initial scene of Luke 12 with all these people around and Jesus speaking to his disciples. But then after this, verse 13, just to catch us up to speed, maybe that next painting, we could begin to notice it by someone interrupting Jesus. Someone from the crowd, verse 13, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus, known as an authority, someone who would perhaps arbitrate these kinds of situations, especially with Jewish inheritance and so forth. He's a religious teacher. Maybe he could help this guy out. "Tell my brother to divide the inheritance and give me mine now." He's looking for his self-interest. And Jesus begins to teach here about finances. And this yet has a point of contact with the earlier message. God's omniscience. He knows about you. He knows how to take care of you. And he begins to speak that same theological message in answer to this man's question. God knows how to take care of us. So don't worry about your wealth and storing up for yourself in these bigger barns and all you have. Rather, Jesus says, "You fool." Verse 20, "This very night your life could be demanded of you. Be rich toward God." Verse 21. Verse 22, we're back to his disciples. He's speaking directly to his disciples. "Therefore I tell you, don't worry about your life, what you'll eat, what you'll drink, what you'll wear. Body's more than food. Body's more than clothing. Life's more than food," verse 23. And then this sequence, and if you have a red-letter Bible, here's where putting the whole of the chapter together can be helpful. Notice in verse 22, Jesus begins to speak. And last week we stopped at verse 34. We're picking up today in verse 35. But I'm noticing this with you here because there's no break between verse 34 and the beginning of verse 35. This is all one unit of thought. That is to say, Jesus' statements about God's omniscience and provision are not to be divorced from his statements here about readiness, vigilance. And that's where we'll begin today, thinking about vigilance toward the kingdom. And if we are vigilant, then we are going to resemble good household stewardship. That's where we'll move next. And the hinge is Peter's question. Now, Jesus, is this for us, just the disciples, or is this for everyone? And Jesus begins to speak here yet in parable, beginning there in verse 41, about household stewardship. And Jesus takes all of the disciples' life, and he uses this metaphor as the umbrella. Think of all of your life as a household steward, absolutely committed to your master's program, to his agenda, so that you manage life a certain way. And we'll find that if we do that, the world is not going to be happy with us. We'll be rejected. We're not going to be those who are lots of fun at parties. Not a lot of likes there. Because our orientation is different. And that is going to lead to rejection. So three ideas in sequence here. We will finish Luke 12 next week, review these ideas again, and be able to put the whole sequence together. Today we're almost there in three ideas. This urgency, this watchfulness, this vigilance toward the kingdom. And if we are that way, we're going to be like these household stewards. The problem is, those who are faithful household stewards, because we're here in the world, we're going to rub the world the wrong way. And that will lead to rejection. So we're vigilant, despite the fact that we may be opposed for our lifestyle. You see the full outline there in your bulletin. Why might your discipleship not receive lots of likes? Jesus urges us to be vigilant in service to God while we wait the day of deliverance at His return. And this will be contrary to the here and now, me first mentality of the world. And we'll do that despite the rejection we might face from those who do not fear God. What we're thinking about in terms of the world is those who don't fear God, those who don't operate on Jesus' theological terms, that God is the omniscient one who's already numbered the hairs of head of all of humanity, the one who knows the very worthless birds, five sold for two pennies and all the rest, the God who's intimately concerned with all the details of our lives, those who don't fear Him, that's the world. And our discipleship will not be liked by them. Notice with me then in the text. We left off here in verses 22 and following, a great and encouraging passage of Scripture familiar to many Christians. Look here at God's omniscience, verse 27 again. Consider how the wildflowers grow. They don't labor or spin thread. And yet not even Solomon was clothed like one of these when he was in all of his splendor. God is able to provide. This is again bouncing off of the man's question from the crowd, tell my relative to divide the inheritance with me. And God here, Jesus here speaking about God's omniscience, His care, His ability to provide. These great words, verse 31, seek first His kingdom. These things will be provided for you. Don't be afraid, little flock. Don't be afraid, little flock. God is able to take care of you. And we leave this paragraph, verses 31, little flock, we're small and weak, and God is powerful and strong and able to care for us. And it's here that if we stop and we don't recognize what's to follow, what we will end with is that we are not to be anxious about what we should wear. We're not to be anxious about provision because God will take care of us, and we can almost lull ourselves to sleep. Don't be anxious. Don't be anxious. God will take care of you. You're a little flock. You're weak. It's okay. Just He'll take care. And we miss that though we shouldn't be anxious about what we will wear, or what we will eat, or our own provisions, that does not mean we should not be concerned about something with our lives. Notice how urgent the language is of the text. Don't be afraid, verse 32, little flock. Your Father delights to give you the kingdom. So look at this, verse 33. Look at the devotion required. So sell your possessions and give to the poor. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now, without a break, even if your Bible has one, without a break, there's still Jesus talking. This is all discourse. There's no break. Look at verse 35, and look at verses 35 through 40, and notice with me the idea of vigilance. Though we are not to be anxious about provision, it does not mean we lead a life that's uncaring. We rather are caring about our faithfulness to God. Notice what is said. Be ready for service, verse 35. Have your lamps lit. You must be like people waiting for their master to return from the wedding banquet, so that when he comes and knocks, notice the urgency of verse 36. When he comes and knocks, they can open the door for him at once. The idea of at once is immediately, now. When he arrives, door open. Not later, now, immediately. This word of immediately surfaces throughout the Gospels, especially it's Mark's favorite word for Jesus' activity. And immediately this happened, and immediately this happened, and immediately this happened. This, friends, is not an unconcerned lifestyle. Do you see what I'm saying? Don't be anxious about what you have. God will take care of you. That does not mean we lead a life that's unconcerned. Be concerned. Be very concerned. And notice the details of this parable. Verse 37, those slaves the master will find alert when he comes. They'll be blessed, I assure you. He will get ready, have them recline at the table, then come and serve them. This is God's kindness, reward for faithfulness, for vigilance, for watchfulness. There's an attitude that because God is able to take care of me, I'm not going to be anxious about myself. I'm rather going to be further concerned about Him, about attending to Him, His kingdom. This is what seek first His kingdom looks like. Seek it first over our own just comforts of life, even. Verse 38. If he comes in the middle of the night, or later, 3, 4, 5 in the morning, dawn, finds them alert, those slaves, it's those slaves who are blessed. But know this, if the homeowner had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have let his house be broken into. You also, verse 40, must be what? Ready. The idea I'm suggesting here is vigilance. Just because God knows the hairs on our head, knows the birds, knows our needs, promises to provide, and we should not be anxious for our provisions, it does not mean that the Christian life or discipleship is an unconcerned life. Rather, it's, I trust you to meet my needs. God, I want to be concerned about you. And all of the time. Ken Hughes comments, a Hebrew wedding celebration could last several days, so the time of the master's return could be anyone's guess. But the uncertainty did not put off these excellent servants. Though it was late at night, they were dressed and ready. The night was also kept bright because they vigilantly replenished the oil in their lamps. They trimmed the wicks for maximum light. They were awake and alert. That's how Jesus' followers are to wait for Him. It's not to be passive, lethargic wait, but one filled with active service, continual preparation, and joyous anticipation. There's intensity and focus to discipleship. Intensity and focus not for how we are going to get more in the here and now, not for how we can have bigger barns, not for how we can have more wealth, more influence in that sense, more comfort. Rather, our anxiety, if you will, our concern is for the kingdom, for the attentiveness that we must have to the master and his return. All of this has in view judgment, the day of judgment. Look at verse 40. You also be ready because the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. This Son of Man's coming is this day of judgment, the day of reconciliation, the day of reward, recompense for those who've been faithful. This has been hinted at even in the last paragraph. Look at verse 28. Have you ever noticed this? Speaking about provision, we noted verse 27 already. Oh, consider the wildflowers, they don't labor or spin. Not even Solomon in all of his glory was clothed as one of these. If that's how God clothes the grass which is in the field today, and notice this grass in the field, what is grass when it's not in the field normally used for in an agrarian culture? It's used for feed for animals. It's used for making baskets or clothes even or coverings. Notice the language of judgment that's applied to the grass. What does it say? Thrown into the fire, the furnace, and burned. That's judgment language. It's already been hinted at here. Verse 40, you be ready because the Son of Man is coming and now you're done. It's vigilance. It's vigilance. That's discipleship. Christian discipleship is vigilant for the kingdom the way a greedy man is vigilant for more money. It's vigilant for the master's return and faithfulness day by day and ready, oriented in life and decisions by hope in the day of redemption at Christ's return. That's the motivating factor, the way larger barns, more comfort, nicer things motivates a greedy man. Don't be like that. Don't be anxious for your life. But that does not mean that you are not concerned about something. Discipleship's not casual. It's committed. It's vigilant. Midnight, before dawn, ready, so at once we can open the door. And Peter's confused. Verse 4. Are you telling this parable, verse 41, to us or everyone? Can you help me along here, Lord? I'm not sure exactly who you are speaking to at this point. Is this for us? Is this for others? And Jesus answers with another parable, and he speaks this parable in such a way that it seems that he's setting out here all of life within this parable, all of a disciple's life here. Verse 42, who then is the faithful and sensible manager his master will put in charge of his household servants to give them their allotted food at the proper time? Jesus begins to answer indirectly. This could be a one-word answer, right? Is this for us or the crowds? It's A or B, one or the other. But he begins to teach here, to unpack this parable. And in this parable of this household manager, we have a framework for all of life. Household managers aren't just important in the ancient world, even in the modern world. Just this week, getting ready for preaching, I came across, just watching on social media, Wall Street Journal had this article about Napa Valley and wines in Napa Valley and managers there. The reporter begins her report, although winemakers are overly fond of proclaiming that wine is made in the vineyard, none of the professionals whose job actually requires them to be in vineyards every day ever said this to me. Perhaps they consider it self-evident as a fact, or perhaps it's because vineyard managers don't tend to speak in sound bites. She goes on to chronicle these vineyard managers and their work in the vineyards, watching over the crops and watching over people. One of the vineyard managers whom she interviewed said this, or she said this about him. He is particularly focused on making sure his workers are paid as much as, if not more than, the workers at other vineyard companies. This gentleman is planning to raise the hourly wage of his workers. It was necessary, he said, to retain top talent all the way through until harvest. And that is the exact picture of a farm steward in the ancient world. In the ancient world, these farms were expensive and they were owned often by city aristocrats who would hire these skilled managers who had great abilities with processes and people. I've read a couple of these books titled On Agriculture by ancient agronomists, and they're in some ways historians, and they write with great detail about the way that the farm should be managed, this process and that one, where watering should be done, where the animals should be kept, what crops should be rotated. But in the midst of all of that, they talk about these skilled managers. These who are entrusted with a manager's wishes, or rather with an owner's wishes, so that the owner's wishes are carried out in both what is done on the farm and who does it. These are men who are skilled in both processes and people. And notice how that surfaces just right here. Verse 43, that slave, and verse 43, slave here is this household manager, that slave whose master finds him working when he comes will be rewarded. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that slave says in his heart, my master is delaying his company, and starts to beat the male and female slaves to eat and drink and get drunk, that slave's master will come on a day he does not expect him, on a day he does not know. He'll cut him into pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. Stop there for just a moment. In just the general framework of a household manager, making sure that the owner's wishes are done and in the practices of what is taking place on the farm, be it with animals or crops or whatever, and with the people, here what is set out is how the people are supplied for. How these under slaves, those who are hired perhaps with less freedom, how they are cared for. If this household manager doesn't pay them, keeps for himself, gets drunk, spends this on himself, takes this for himself, his view at that point is exposed. He's not vigilant. He's not operating by the owner's agenda. He's just looking for the here and the now. Just for me. I have this surplus. I'm not going to give it out to them. It's for me. It's for the here and the now. Verse 46 says that that slave will be cut into pieces and assigned a place with the unbelievers. And that slave who knew his master's will and didn't prepare himself to do it, he'll be severely beaten, verse 47. Verse 48 concludes that the degree to which one knows what to do and doesn't do it is the degree to which he or she will be judged. But the one who did not know and did things deserving of blows will be beaten lightly. Much will be required of everyone who's been given much, and even more will be expected of the one who's been entrusted with more. Let's pause there for a moment and just synthesize verses 42 through 49, recognizing that there is no break besides our editors putting a break here to verse 49, which we'll get to in a moment. But for just convention's sake, let this set for a minute. If you were not reading this in Luke 12, and you just heard this passage, perhaps it were the basis of a topical message at a conference or something like that, or used in a Christian book, what theme would come up? It's likely stewardship, isn't it? It's likely stewardship. You need to take care of the things entrusted to you. You need to be someone who takes care of what you've got, takes care of the processes that are around you in your life and the people who are under you, if you will, or dependent upon you or you're around. You need to take care of them. This is stewardship. This is good stewardship. So there it is. God wants you to be a good steward. You need to take care of the processes around you, the people around you. Go. Go do it. There it is. And if you were to hear that message or just skim that book, and let's just say you went to a bookstore like Barnes & Noble somewhere, you could go to the business section and say, God sounds just like their latest business leader. All I need, I just need to take care of the processes of my business, make sure that the I's are dotted, T's are crossed, make sure I carry out the person over me, their wishes here, and I need to make sure that I care for the people. Yeah, God's a great business leader. I always knew he'd get something right. Right? No. This is all about the day of the Son of Man and his return. This is about fearing God. This is not just about stewardship. This is about vigilant living. It's here where the frame of Luke 12 shades this a good bit different than the popular business books. I mean, on the surface, this works, doesn't it? On the surface, you could be saying, Pastor Todd, how could someone be rejected for living this good way? I mean, even in my job, if I lived this way, if I was just faithful with the processes around me and the people that are sort of under me, I'd get kudos from my boss. And if you who are a manager, you look at this and you say, oh, I wish I had this, right? If I just had people beneath me who were concerned about I's dotted and T's crossed and people who I just gave them a generous wage and they were, I would love this, I want this, right? And that's true to a degree. But as soon as it becomes apparent that our work ethic and our lifestyle isn't really about our brand, then our boss's feathers are going to be ruffled. Because my patterns of life are not about this business. Even though this kind of a lifestyle should be expressed in our workplaces, it's about anticipating Christ's return. It's about vigilance. Rich Mullins got it right in his song, You Did Not Have a Home. His lyric, speaking about Jesus, the world can't stand what it can't own. And it can't own you because you did not have a home. If we are living this way, yes, there's a sense in which we may climb some ladders in the corporate world. We may get bonuses and it might all be good for us. But it's also the case that when it comes to company parties, when it comes to maybe a boss forcing something just a bit, let's press this a little bit. Let's fudge this number. Let's fake this account. Let's do this a little bit. And you begin to change your work habits. You begin to say, no, I'm not going to do that. It's here where your boss said, I thought you were in on this with me. I counted on you. I put you over people. I put you over processes. I expect this of you. It's right there where you will get rejected. It's right there because you will be an exhibit of Christianity and discipleship, not owned by a brand, but owned by Christ. And it's right there that you might get rejected. I've said a good bit based upon this metaphor and applied it strictly to work, but we need to allow just a moment for this metaphor to encompass now all of our lives. When Jesus speaks here about household stewardship, he's not giving a business seminar. He's talking about the character of life. And it's here where our vigilance about the kingdom and the way we live may get some pushback, not just from a boss at work, from a family member, a neighbor, someone near you. We need to be careful, as the New Testament says. We're not just out to be jerk Christians, but if we are truly vigilant about the kingdom, there will be rejection. That's the logic of Jesus' discourse. Notice verse 49. I came to bring fire on the earth. Have we seen fire already? Yes, verse 28. Grass that is burned. All of this has in view judgment, the final day. I came to bring fire on the earth, and how I wish it were already set ablaze. Notice the intensity of Jesus' language. Your translation may have exclamation points after verses 49 and 50. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how it consumes me until it is finished. Here's Jesus' own personal vigilance for God's kingdom, for God's role for him to play in it. Do you think I came here to give peace to the earth? No, I tell you, rather division. And if we are vigilant for the kingdom, yes, we may be rewarded from time to time, but when push comes to shove or motives are revealed of those around us and they are set beside our motivations, we're going to be like those who aren't very fun to be at a party. Come on, goody two-shoes. You know, your little song and dance isn't so welcome around here. Take your show on the road. We are sick of you putting your morals on these adult men. Be ready. Do you think I came here to give peace? Verse 51, no, division. From now on, five in one household will be divided, three against two, two against three. It's so bad it'll come near even to one's own household. All of life in view. I have referenced, I think, in nearly every message, Luke chapter 4 and the outset of Jesus' ministry. And there in Nazareth, where he takes the scroll, Isaiah 61, and opens it. The day of the Lord has come. This is the year of the Lord's favor. The Spirit's upon me to proclaim good news to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind. This great scene. And do you know what happened in Nazareth? It wasn't a revival. Isn't this Joseph's son? Joseph, what's got into your kid? We've seen him just, you know, he's always been a little too good for everybody else. When the world, those who don't fear God, are confronted by we who do, they are never appreciative. It's always rejection because it brings guilt. The world loves to be drunk with other drunks. Get somebody sober talking about AA. Get out of here. Jesus quotes from Micah to make his point. Micah, a contemporary of Isaiah, watched Israel be taken captive by the Assyrians. You remember in Micah 6:8, the great statement, what does the Lord require of you? Act justly. Love mercy. Walk humbly with God. Just that. Just three. Act justly. Love mercy. Walk humbly with God. And in the next chapter, what Jesus quotes here, Micah is saying, that doesn't happen. In fact, things are so bad that here it is. They will be divided, father against son. That's not acting justly, loving mercy, and walking humbly with God. Son against father, mother against daughter, daughter against mother, mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law, daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. It's in all directions. That's the point. Anywhere you look, someone who's vigilant is going to be rejected, and even by family relations. This is the fire Jesus came to bring. And vigilance is going to earn a reward from God, but not from the world. They're not going to like it. It's going to be contrary to their patterns. What harm does it do to anyone that the royals would have this for their own players? Does that really harm anyone else? It doesn't harm anyone else. But they're wrong. It's going to irk them. It's going to lead to rejection. That's why our discipleship may not get lots of likes. I want to tease out just a few spheres here for us this morning where this idea of discipleship and not getting lots of likes will surface, and I hope this helps just a few spheres along the way. First, I think this very flow of text has a framework for our parenting. If you are concerned to raise Christian kids, we are going to have to teach them that with fearing God, there is great reward, despite what the world says. And fear of man, as Proverbs said, will be a snare. And fear of man will compromise their faith. Our kids live in a world where they are culturally imbued with a need to fear man. Fear those who are powerful. Fear those who are around them in their peer group. And social media has pressed that all the more strongly. The elders and interns are reading Ed Welch's book, When People Are Big and God Is Small. It deals with this very issue of fearing God. Welch makes the point, people are our idol of choice. They predate Baal, money, and power. They are worshipped because we perceive that they have power to give us something. We think they can bless. We need to teach our children from Luke 12 that God is concerned for their needs and He will bless. Their peer group, their non-Christian coaches, they don't have God's interests in mind here. Fear Him, not them. These peer groups, outside influences, I mentioned coaches, it could be any number of outside influences, those cannot bless you like God can. Fear Him. Second, money. I bring this up because it flows right through the text. Have you noticed, by the way, how Jesus is using several issues and putting parables around them? Money, work, very practical ideas, and all of these related to the kingdom. And it's consistently the case that we come back to Luke 12, as it's stated in the Sermon on the Mount as well, and recognize God is able to provide. And I say that to you today, whether the economy is as ripe as it is now or in a time of depression that may come, we look to God to provide. We trust Him. He is our provider. He is the one who knows our needs, and we seek Him first. It's in times of prosperity, like now, where our hearts and money are just as revealed as in poverty. Are we rich toward the kingdom? And third, our work. As I've stated already, this is right from Jesus' teaching in parables here. With excellence, concerned for peoples and processes, but beware, especially you who are skilled at your work, beware that your brand owns you. Beware that so powerful are those inclinations to work and a culture where work is valued. Beware that your brand not own you, though you serve it well. That is not your home.